So the last talk of this session would be given by Andrew Childs of MIT, and the topic would be spatial search by consciousness.
Can you move it down? I have a backup hand.
Excuse me, could somebody open this main press? Yeah. Thank you very much, man.
Naively apply Grover's algorithm. Well, first of all, it's very clear that in one dimension, actually, regardless of what we do, there's no better thing that you can do than brute force search, just to go down the line. Because it might be that you start at one end of the line, and the thing you're trying to find is located n sites away. So you can get no speed up at all in one dimension. So it's just not an interesting case. But in higher dimensions, you might get some kind of speed up, and Benioff, in this paper in 2000, considered this problem in the context of what he called a quantum robot, which is like a quantum computer that can move into superpositions of different locations. So it's got a quantum memory, and it also has a position, and it can move around, and it can do so in superposition. So he thought about a quantum robot possibly doing this on a d-dimensional lattice, and he found actually that you couldn't do as well as actually was later shown. So he thought that if you apply Grover's algorithm using this kind of quantum robot, that each iteration would have to take about n to the 1 over d steps, because this is like the radius of your database, and you might have to move that far. And so if you perform square root of n Grover iterations, where each one of them takes n to the 1 over d steps, then you have an order n to the 1 half plus 1 over d algorithm, so if d is equal to 2, this is no better than brute force search. It's terrible. If t is large, then maybe it's some kind of an improvement, but you're not doing as well as the square root of n that Grover can achieve in the combinatorial search problem. So, there's a question, can we do better than this? And indeed, we can. So, there was a very recent result in a paper that's on the archive by Scott Aronson and Anders Levinas, where they came up with a clever algorithm for this problem, and their algorithm uses some kind of recursive search of subcubes, the size of which are chosen in some careful way. And then the result of this search is the search is made deterministic. The probability of success of the search of the subcubes is amplified using the process of amplitude amplification. And by doing this and analyzing some recursion relations, they were able to show that if they're searching a lattice whose dimension is greater than 2, and they can search it with this algorithm in time of order square root of n, which is great. There's no better than it, of course, because of the PPVV value. But in d equals 2, their algorithm, when it's searching for, when there's only one marked item in the context that I've been discussing, runs in time of order square root of n times log of n squared. So it's a little bit slower than the best you could possibly do. And it would be interesting if you could improve that. So our goal in looking at this problem was originally to see if we can improve that, and as I'll say later on, we were actually not able to improve it. But what we did was to try to approach this problem using quantum walks, and I think you learned some interesting things along the way by going through this construction. And also in particular, I mean, our algorithm uses very simple Hamiltonian dynamics. It's kind of the minimal construction you could possibly imagine. There's no carefully aligned recursion going on. And in fact, the state space of a quantum computer consists only of its position. So it has no internal states that it's using to make some type of decision. The algorithm takes place just in an n-dimensional Hilbert space, with absolutely no auxiliary space. So we can state this algorithm in a way that's applicable to any graph G, and I'll tell you how it actually works in some particular cases. So if you run this algorithm where G is the complete graph, okay, which is not a spatially local case, the most non-local it could possibly be, you find that it reduces exactly to this analog-analog or continuous-time version of the Grover algorithm, which was proposed by Farhad Dutton in 1996, and it has a runtime of order square root of n. So the question is, can we make it more local than that? So the first kind of baby step that we can make is to go to the log n-dimensional hypercube. And here again, by some previous results which are in the literature, we can show that the algorithm runs in time of order square root of n. But this is really not good enough, because we would sort of like to be able to search regions of physical space which have some finite dimensions, which doesn't depend on the size of the database that we're searching. So we want to consider a d-dimensional lattice where d is fixed independent of n. And what we find is that if we run this algorithm that we're proposing, if d is greater than 4, then indeed we find square root of n speed up. So it runs in time of order square root of n. But d equals 4, rather than d equals 2, is kind of a borderline case, and we get some kind of additional logarithmic factor. And then in d less than 4, the algorithm actually provides no speed up. So this d equals 2 case is not improved by our All right, so I'm going to explain basically what the algorithm is, and it's stated in the language of quantum walk, so let me just recall some things about graphs and matrices. The algorithm will be defined in terms of some undirected graph, which has no self-loop, so compared to Strunson, general undirected graph, and that graph can be specified in terms of its adjacency matrix, which just has ones on the off-diagonal elements corresponding to the vertices which connect it. So there are n vertices in the graph, it's an n by n matrix, and there are just ones for corresponding to the edges. And then we can define the Laplacian, which is this adjacency matrix A, minus the diagonal matrix, where the jth element on the diagonal is just the degree of vertex j, so the number of edges coming out of that vertex. And this is something that we might want to do in general for graphs which have mixed degree, like this graph. Actually, every graph that I consider in this talk will be regular. So this matrix D will be a multiple of the identity matrix, and actually won't affect the dynamics. But we want to state it in general.
What's the self-loop?
So that I can write just this equation and not have to talk about the case where j is equal to k.
Well,
so in other words, there are no edges that come from one vertex back.
Oh, I understand. Okay, that's the same.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, so Eddie talked about this yesterday, but I'm just going to go through how a quantum walk is defined and how it's related to a random walk in case anybody wasn't here yesterday. But I'll go through it kind of quickly. So a random walk, well, I'll talk about a random walk in continuous time, but in general, a random walk on a graph is a state space consisting of the n vertices of the graph, which are numbering from 1 to n, and there's some pj, which is the probability that we're at vertex j. So there's a differential equation which describes how these probabilities evolve in time, and it just says that the time derivative of pj is equal to some jumping rate down times the Laplacian operator acting on the vector of probabilities. So this just describes the way this probability moves around in the graph. So as I said, this matrix L, which is the generator of the time evolution, we choose just to be the Laplacian of the graph. And when we do that, we find the probability is conserved. That's why, in this case, we want to use the Laplacian rather than, something else. So that the property that Laplacian has, that the column sum is zero, means that the time derivative of the sum of probabilities should always be one, is indeed equal to zero. I mean, if this sum is originally equal to one, then it stays equal to one. It doesn't change in time. So quantum mechanically, instead of having these n vertices, we have n orthonormal basis states, which we just label with the vertices in the graph. And we let qj be the amplitude to be a vertex j. So if we do this, and we look at the Schrodinger equation, we find that it looks a lot like the equation describing the random walk. It just has an I on it. So the time derivative for qj is just this operator, which we all know and love, the Hamiltonian, acting on the vector of amplitudes. So if we like, we could just choose the generator of the time evolution to be some multiple of Laplacian. Here I'm choosing minus gamma times the Laplacian, so that the Hamiltonian is a positive operator. Well, that's just for convenience. We could make any other choice in which the Hamiltonian is Hermitian to have a proper normalization. This is the choice that I'm going to talk. All right, so now that I've told you what a quantum walk is, I'll tell you what the search algorithm that we propose is. First of all, I have to say something about how the mark state is identified. So we have this notion of an oracle Hamiltonian, which is HW, which is minus a projector onto the W state. So this Hamiltonian has an energy minus 1 for the W state and an energy 0 for everything else. So this really is capturing the notion of unstructured search, that the state W is marked, but all of the other states are not distinguished. There's nothing that's pointing you to the winner. Now the algorithm is as follows. We start in state S, which is the uniform superposition over all vertices of the graph. And then we just let the walk evolve according to this Hamiltonian, which has the Hamiltonian of the quantum walk minus gamma times L plus HW, which is minus this projector onto the W state. So that's just this simple time-independent dynamics of the algorithm. And then we just, after this time t has elapsed, we measure the position with the the walk has gotten to, and we would like it to be W. So the goal is that we choose this parameter, gamma, which is at our disposal, and the total runtime of the algorithm, T, so that the probability of finding W when we make this measurement is as close to 1 as possible. And of course, we'd like T to not be too big. We'd like it to be ideally of order squared of n, which is the best it could possibly be. All right. So, you know, this is a proposal, but it may not be clear at all that it's reasonable. I mean, it might be that there are no values of gamma and T for which there's a large probability that we find the W. So I just want to give you a little bit of motivation for why this might possibly work. And indeed, this, it will turn out that this is basically the way that it does work when it does work. Right, so I've just put the Hamiltonian up here to remind you what it is. And on this axis down here, I'm going to plot the parameter gamma, which is something that we have to choose. So if we consider gamma large, then essentially just this term, minus gamma L, corresponding to the graph, going to be the only thing that really contributes significantly to the Hamiltonian. So the ground state will be basically just the ground state of the Laplacian of the graph, which is essentially this S state that we're choosing to start. So S is approximately an eigenstate for gamma large. On the other hand, if we choose gamma small, then, well, if we took gamma to be equal to zero, then the Hamiltonian would be just HW. So the ground state would be W. And if we consider gamma, which is a little bit away from zero, then it's pretty easy to see by perturbation theory that the first excited state would be close to the S state. Basically because, the way the degeneracy is broken, since this is the ground state of the thing over here, it's going to be the first excited state over here. So it might be the case, certainly not logically impossible, that there could be some critical range of gamma in the middle, between gamma small and gamma large, where the ground state changes as you change gamma from W to S, and it can pass through a state like S plus W that has a big overlap on both the S state and on the W state. And it could also be the case, since clearly the S state is participating here near the low line of states in the spectrum, and the first excited state could be like the orthogonal state, S minus W. And if that's the case, and you evolve according to this Hamiltonian, starting on the state S, then you can see that basically what's happening is you're rotating between the state S and the state W. So if you wait for a time, which is proportional to 1 over the difference in energy between the first excited state and the ground state, then you'll rotate from the state S to the state W, and you'll have a solution to your circuit. All right, so now I'll explain how this works in a particular in a couple of particular examples. So the simplest one is the complete graph. And this, as I said, is reduced to a previous thing that happened. So here's the complete graph on 8 vertices. And in general, if you add a multiple of the identities of the Laplacian, so n times the identity, you just get n times the projector onto the S state, or in other words, the matrix of all vertices. Okay? So this is like a matrix describing the kind of idea of a complete graph. Everything is connected. So, because we can just discard multiples of the identity because they don't affect time evolution, let's just work with the Hamiltonian minus gamma n times a projector onto S minus a projector onto W. So now if we choose the critical value of gamma n equals 1, so we let gamma be 1 over n, that's the choice we're allowed to make, then we get this continuous time rover algorithm, and we actually find, well, it's very easy to analyze the spectrum of this operator because, you know, it's really just, although there are n states in the problem, there are really just 2 states that have any significance, S and W. So you can work everything out because everything goes on in a two-dimensional subspace. And you find that for large n, the eigenstates are approximately S plus or minus W with a gap of more than 1 over the square root of n. So if you wait for a time of more than the square root of n, you rotate from S to W. And that's kind of captured in this picture, and I'll show pictures like this for the other cases, so it's worthwhile to see what's going on here. So there are 2 kinds of things that I'm plotting on this graph. This curve here is that energy gap, so it's the difference of the first excited state energy and the ground state energy. So that curve has a minimum around gamma equals 1, which is the value that I chose you to take, that I told you to choose for the search algorithm. All right, so the other thing that's plotted on here is overlaps of states W and S with the ground state, which I'm going to have in psi 0, and my first excited state, which I'm going to have in psi 1. So you can see that at the place where this gap is a minimum, there's a distinct change in the ground state as you change the gamma from less than this critical value to greater than this critical value. So over here, the ground state is essentially W, right? That we overlap with W on the ground state. And over here, it's switched to S. And correspondingly, the first excited state over here is essentially S, and over here is essentially W. And here I plotted this in particular for N equals to 1,000 point of voltage. So the picture kind of all hangs together. If we choose the right value of gamma, choose gamma equals 1 over N, then we have this kind of dynamics where in time square root of N, we can rotate from our initial state S to our final state W. So this picture actually carries over to other graphs, and that's basically the content of this work. If you look at the hypercube, for example, this is a graph where we can label the vertices by n-bit string. So here, capital N string, 2 to the little n. And the adjacency matrix of this graph can just be written as a sum of spin operators, the sigma x operator acting on the j qubit of the system, which is to decompose this thing into qubits. And here the Hamiltonian is just minus gamma times the adjacency matrix of this thing. Again, it's regular, so we'll just subtract off that multiple of the identity, minus WW, and you can analyze this thing using total spin operators. And this is done actually in this paper, which is about a related but different subject. And you can see that it works again at some critical value of gamma. So here's the plot. This turns out to go like one over little n, this value of gamma where the gap is a minimum. And you can see a very similar picture. For gamma less than critical value, the ground state is essentially W. For gamma greater than that critical value, the ground state is essentially S, and vice versa for the first excited state. So over here, the first excited state is basically S, and over here, the first excited state is basically W. Well, sorry, not in the whole range of gamma greater than critical value, but in enough of a region. In the region of the critical value, there's a big overlap of W in the first excited state. So that's all you need. You pick this critical value of gamma, and you rotate from S to W in time without square root. All right. So the hard case is a d-dimensional lattice where D is fixed independent of N. And as I said, I'm not going to present really any of the details of this. I'd be happy to discuss it with you, or you can look at it in the paper. But basically, because you can understand the spectrum of the Hamiltonian before you add this projector on the W, you can understand the spectrum after you do it. So if we let the graph be a periodic cubic lattice with a total of n sites, so in other words, the side length of each side of the cube is n to the 1 over d, then it's very easy to write down the exact eigenstates and eigenvalues of L. They're just given by plane waves, and the energies are given by some function of all the cosines. So we know the whole spectrum before we have W, and we can use some tricks to analyze it after we have W. So now I'll show you some plots which basically present the results, and I'll tell you what the size of these of the critical region is, how big the gap is, and eventually what the runtime is as we vary the dimension. So let me start in the case where it works, which is D greater than 4. In particular, here I've shown the case D equals 5. So this is a lattice, again, of 1,024 sites. So it's the side length is 4, so it's got 4 to 5 sites. And you can see it looks a lot like a picture of the hypercube. I mean, it's high-dimensional, so it doesn't really look so different. Here the gap, again, has a minimum at some critical value of gamma. We can actually calculate that critical value of gamma star. It turns out to be some constant, which just depends on D. For n large, it just goes to some constant value. And we'll find in all of these cases, even as I lower D, that for gamma less than the critical value, S is basically first excited state. For gamma greater than the critical value, it's basically the ground state. But for gamma in the region of the critical value, we can actually get an interesting outcome. So there's a region around this critical gamma which has an extent of order 1 over the square root of n. And if we're within that region, we find that this gap goes like 1 over the square root of n. So that's the runtime that goes like the square And if we look at the eigenstates in the critical feature, we find that they look like S plus or minus some number of order 1 times W. So in other words, there's an order 1 overlap in both S and W, and we have essentially the same picture. We rotate from S to W at a time and the order is right. Alright, so now let's start to lower the dimension, and interesting things will start to happen. So four dimensions is really the critical dimension, and this is really kind of the most interesting case. Here there's some critical region, which is again at some critical value of gamma star, which is some constant independent of n. But the critical region is a little bit wider, so it's order squared root of log n over n. And of course, you know, it's the same. If we look to the left of the critical region or to the right of the critical region, we again find that S is approximately an eigenstate. So this is not a good place to work. But if we look near the critical region, we do find that S and W both play a significant role in the ground of the first excited states, but not enough to have as fast an algorithm as we'd like. So, well, first of all, E1 minus E0 goes like order 1 over square root of n log n. So this is already not good. So it's going to take a little bit longer to get to an orthogonal state. But the ground of first excited states also look like S plus or minus some amount of W that decreases with n. So the overlap on W goes like order 1 over the square root of log n. So we find that if we let this thing run for a time of order square root n log n, so we've rotated to the orthogonal state, we really only have an overlap on W which goes like, the probability that we find W goes like the square of this, so it goes like 1 over log n. So if we want to repeat the algorithm, so we don't have a large probability of success, but if we want to repeat the algorithm to amplify the probability of success, we have to do that about log n times. So if we put all of this together, we find the runtime of order square root of n times the 3 halves power of log n. So in other words, we're not finding the full speed up. And you could do maybe slightly better than this using amplitude amplification rather than classical repetition, but regardless, you can't get all the way down to order square root of n by this method. It just doesn't work. So as we lower the dimension, things are only going to get worse. If we look at a three-dimensional lattice, we find that the width of the critical region is wider. It's of order 1 over the cube root of n. And now the value of the gap in the critical region goes like 1 over 2/3 of power of n. So the time it's going to take, the time that we choose to run the algorithm for will be proportional to n to the 2/3. And also the overlap on the W state is smaller. So if we look in the critical region, the overlap of the ground and first excited states on the W state, the amplitude goes like 1 over n to the 1/6, and the probability would go like 1 over n to the 1/3. So the time that we would have to run this algorithm using repetition to get a large probability of success, the probability of success in order 1, would actually be about order n. So we would have no improvement over the classical algorithm, which is not so great. And then, of course, as we decrease the dimension further, it's just going to get horrible. In two dimensions, actually, we find the runtime, which is even worse than classical algorithm. Of course, this is nothing you would ever try to do. It just works horribly in two dimensions. So one thing,
just a curious.
I don't even have a plot in one dimension. It would be even worse.
I understand that outward.
In one dimension, if I recall right, the gap at the critical value goes like order 1 over n, and I don't know what this is, so I can't tell you off the top of my head, but it would be even worse. There wouldn't be a log of this. It's an odd number of dimensions, but I can't say exactly what it would be. Alright, so I just want to... Yeah, Charlie?
But surprisingly, in zero dimensions, it's always easy to do the search because you're there already.
you have a divergence and then
you can't have n items in zero dimensions. So that's definitely one dimension isn't an interesting case, but zero dimensions is really not an interesting case. You can't even store your basics.
What about Wi Fi?
Right, so I want to talk about some algorithms which are related to the algorithm that I told you about. And see where you have it connected. So I've talked entirely using these continuous time quantum blocks, which Eddie was also talking about yesterday. But there are other ways to formulate quantum analogs of random walks. In particular, you could try to invent a quantum analog of a discrete time random walk. where instead of having some, you know, Poisson, you know, distribution of jumping to adjacent vertices, it varies continuously in time, you actually have, you know, discrete steps. So you flip a coin and you decide where to go. And this is actually a harder thing to define quantum mechanically. You have to jump through more hoops when you try to define a walk in this way. Basically, to make it unitary becomes hard in presence, not hard in continuous time. But you can do it, and you can define it. And there's this paper which formulates a discrete-time quantum walk search algorithm that works on the hyperloop. And indeed, these authors were able to find an algorithm which runs in time of order square root of n. So, I don't know how interesting this is. It would be interesting to know how this algorithm actually behaves in finite dimensions. There has been some speculation based on numerical evidence that they have that it might actually be a fast algorithm in d equals 2. They said this on the basis of, you know, wanting to have an algorithm in d equals 2 to improve on the Anderson and Binus result. I think on the basis of the analytic work that we've done, that it seems pretty unlikely that it should be the case that we find a fast algorithm. I mean, even though it's a, you know, it's not the same, so the fact that we've shown that our algorithm doesn't work in d equals 2 doesn't logically imply that their algorithm can't work. I mean, they kind of work based on similar principles, so it would be very surprising if their algorithm would work in d equals 2. If it were the case that the discrete-time quantum walk search algorithm were fast in d equals 2, that would be a pretty big difference between the discrete and continuous-time quantum walks, and it would be an interesting thing to know about, but I do think it's unlikely. So there are also algorithms which are related to the algorithm that I described based on the notion of adiabatic evolution. So the case of the complete graph, for these algorithms, is considered in these papers by Juan Kassir and then Dan Mosca and Basarani, which were written, I guess, 2 years ago now. And the idea of adiabatic evolution is also to have some kind of Hamiltonian dynamics that lets you solve a search problem. But instead of having a time-independent Hamiltonian, you have an explicitly time-dependent Hamiltonian. And you try to keep the quantum computer near its ground state by changing the Hamiltonian slowly. So you could do something like that, using the Hamiltonian that I described by slowly changing gamma from large values down to zero. And actually, for any of the cases where the algorithm that I described here works, there would be a corresponding adiabatic. But also in all of the cases where this algorithm fails, the corresponding adiabatic would also fail. So it's related, but it doesn't let you do anything that you couldn't do by these techniques. There are also algorithms which are related to adiabatic algorithms which work based on measurement. So instead of evolving according to this Hamiltonian, you could measure the operator H as you vary gamma. And if you did that in the right way, then you could solve the problem by sort of projecting the state of the system successively into the ground states of the changing Hamiltonian. And again, you would find that if you were clever and chose the right sequence of measurements of this Hamiltonian, so vary gamma, then you would find that this measurement algorithm works in all the cases where the non-measurement algorithm works, where the quantum walk search algorithm and fails in exactly the cases where this algorithm fails. So it's a related algorithm, but again, it doesn't let you do anything which you couldn't do by these methods. All right, so I just want to finish with a couple of open questions. I mean, a big open question that we've been wrestling with is to try to find more applications of quantum walks. And I think this work is kind of interesting because it shows something different that you can do with quantum walks. But, you know, we really have no idea what other kinds of problems you might be able to approach in this way. And I think it's really wide open and there are a lot of possibilities, and it's definitely something worth looking into. And finally, relating to this specific question, it would be interesting to know what's the actual complexity of the search problem in d equals 2. Can you actually do square root of n, or is there some fundamental reason where there has to be a log in two dimensions? You know, if so, what's the best power? So either improving on the Anderson and Binus algorithm, which I don't think we really have any particularly good reason to think is optimal, either improving on that algorithm would be interesting. Or if you could prove some lower bound that showed that you couldn't get full square root of n speed up in two dimensions, so that would also be interesting. So that's all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions, please.
You were always using
lattice is of integer dimension.
Right.
Is there, and yet you have these sort of funny thresholds where it's square, but then it's a little different.
Right.
Is there some kind of fractal lattice of intermediate dimension you could use to find out where that difference kicked in? Like, it could be between 4 and 5 that it happened.
No, it's definitely at 4. I mean, well, it depends what you mean. So you could certainly analytically continue the results that we have in the dimension. So we have some results for example, how the gap behaves as a function of dimension, and they involve some intervals that we have to do. And you could analytically continue those intervals in the dimension. And if that's what you meant by what the algorithm is in a non-integer number of dimensions, then in fact the threshold would be at D equals 4. But of course that doesn't necessarily correspond to some physical structure with a fractional dimension. So if you wanted to actually sort of lay the grid out on a fractal, which had some fractal dimension, then I don't really know what to say. I don't know exactly what would happen. I think it would be a difficult problem to analyze. But it's not clear to me that it would necessarily behave exactly as the analytic continuation of the lattice of dimension.
Yes, please.
Many other presents and other people at the moment, it seems like Hooke is describing a very standard solution problem as the kind of binding lattice with a second order Fourier spectrum, which is a completely, not at least the Eigenstate spectrum and a lot of applications of that around the issue of how to balance state energy in function of how the constant depends on dimension is better to deal with that density space.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think it does look a lot like a standard problem in condensed matter physics.
It is a standard problem.
Okay, so I haven't seen this.
You're starting it from a state and evolving, letting the state evolve. But the standard problem is at least to use this as a model for a simple model in theory.
Sure. So I haven't seen the particular quantities that we investigate, analyze in the literature. And I've certainly looked. Some pointer to that, I would definitely be interested to see that. But I definitely agree that it looks a lot like a standard condensed matter system. Although, we're interested in kind of different things. We're really interested in finite size scaling and understanding really in detail how the thing works in terms of the structure of the lattice.
At least with uniform lattice, it's one of the few problems you can solve explicitly, completely with several potentials. So it's the one kind of similar problem.
More questions, please.
In the Ambinus and Aronson algorithm, there's a recursion that gets used, which is not used in the quantum lock algorithm. In fact, it gets a reducible problem down to finding one parameter, gamma. Is it okay to consider a gamma which varies depending on the vertex, and you change that gamma as a function of time? Maybe in one part of the graph, for some time you change it here, and then another part you change it there, versus having just one fixed gamma for the entire graph?
So when you talk about varying gamma for the graph, I guess you mean you want to vary the elements of the Hamiltonian corresponding to edges in different places of the graph.
Right.
That's certainly a legitimate thing to consider, and it's something that you could try to do. I think it's again something which would make the problem harder to analyze, but you could certainly try to do it. Now, given that freedom, I'm not sure exactly what you would try to do to try to speed things up, but it is certainly something you could play with.
Yes, please, Chuck.
Offhand, it sounds like that would make it worse, because you have no idea where the marked site is, and so if you try to steer it, it's probably going to steer it away.
Like a noise, like being a noise when you want to write the DG. Yeah, this is harder.
Right, but nonetheless, the other algorithm is recursive, so it does use some structure, even though apparently there's no structure to the unordered,
Is the critical value of gamma, would it have to be something interesting?
It's something that we can calculate. You can calculate it as some integral, at least in the cases of pi dimension where the algorithm works. I don't know if this is significant or not. You can relate it to properties of random walks, classical random walks. So, for example, if you consider a classical discrete-time random walk on a discrete lattice, the probability that the walk returns to the origin has something to do with that critical value of gamma. It's numerical value is related. Some simple, very simple function.
For the complete graph, it went like 1 over n, right?
For the complete graph, it went like 1 over n. Now, there I don't know if it's related to just such a quantity. But...
More questions, please? Still, we have a little, a few minutes. Could I ask a layman question? I'm not in this field altogether. And I have two questions. First of all, did anybody try to use this quantum work, say, for training neural networks? Like, say, instead of classical back probe, to do something like that. It may be very effective, because essentially my gut feeling is that quantum mechanics may allow to skip all these local minima, which plug back probe and other algorithms in neural networks.
Well, to answer your question, I certainly don't know anyone who's done that. It might be something...
Just maybe discussion, you ask, what else?
Right.
Maybe very cheap. Okay, and second, completely maybe stupid question. Did anybody try to do, say, flow research on, like you're saying, on hypercubes or hyperlattices? Just wait, classical, but analog computing, like diffusion equation or something. Say, make it each, I put in my system many particles, and each particle is attracted to a certain state, which is analog of your W by W.
Well, if you want to put in many particles and narrow that to move around independently, then that's not really quite within the model that I'm considering. But really, what I imagine is that there's one quantum computer. Well, so in the classical case, there would be one classical robot which can move around the system, one particle.
I do not completely understand, because quantum computer has many gates. So if I'm an electrical engineer, for me, sort of, quantum computer is equivalent, if I map on classical analog computer, to equal number of essentially particles. Or it's on
the let me try to say why I think it's unfair in a different way. I mean, if you allow searching the lattice in some distributed way, then you can certainly search much faster. If you have a computer at your site which can ask, am I at the internet?
No. What I will do, I will put a particle there, so I'm writing the diffusion equation instead of Schrödinger equation on your life. I'm writing the diffusion equation, and then sometime I measure it.
Okay, well, it's one particle that can diffuse, so if you want time to diffuse, you can't do any better than time
over. M? You think M?
Yeah, sure.
Did somebody ask me?
It could be slower, but it's certainly anyway.
It would be nice to get the argument.
Whatever the shape of the graph is, if you put the probability uniformly over the whole thing, and you start matching it in one place,
then
it's going to take at least time order n to find.
No, I don't mean one-dimensional. I know that diffusion in 1D is horrible, but diffusion, typical equation of diffusion, because you have Nablo to D, accelerates in n dimensions, in D dimensions.
Even on a complete graph, it would take that time.
Sorry?
Even on a complete graph, it would take as long.
N?
Yeah.
Somehow my gut feeling says that it should accelerate with D, but I don't know. Okay. Because, diffusion is pathetic in 1D and very good in higher dimensions. Okay. Any other questions? No?
Thank you very much.